the Midtown Detroit studios of WDET. This is Detroit Today.
What kind of services should Detroiters expect from city government? And should some neighborhoods be able to pay more in taxes or fees to get better than what everyone else already has? Those are questions that strike at the heart of issues surrounding the city's deep economic divides and its historical difficulties ensuring that its poorest residents ever get what they need. We'll spend a good part of the day talking it through. Should more money mean better services? And if so, what does that mean for those who already don't have? We'll get the conversation started next on Detroit Today, right after the news. Welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for being here. Residents in some of Detroit's wealthier neighborhoods are soon going to pay higher taxes for better services. That includes better security and snow removal in places like Palmer Woods and Sherwood Forest. A recent change in city law makes it easier for community organizations to create these so-called special assessment districts if a majority of residents sign off. We've seen this in lots of other cities around the country, but till now, this hasn't really been possible here in Detroit. But what about neighborhoods that can't afford to shell out an extra few hundred dollars a year? Have adequate city services become a luxury for a lot of people in places like Detroit? Does this highlight an affordability problem that's keeping people from moving here and keeping the quality of life low for those who don't live in wealthier neighborhoods? In just a moment, we're going to be joined by City Councilman James Tate to talk about the neighborhood taxes. But first, WDET producer Jake Neer spoke with Detroiter Edwin Cole outside of his house in Palmer Woods. Cole says he's conflicted about the higher taxes he's soon going to pay to get better services.
It's good to a certain extent because we've had some break-ins. We've had some other issues when cars are breaking into cars. So security for all of the associations in this area has been cut back due to lack of funds. So I suspect that they should bring up the security a great deal more.
How do you feel about the fact that in the city already taxes, property taxes are very high, and that even though that's the case, certain neighborhoods are now asking for even higher taxes to, you know, get the level of services from the city that they feel is appropriate. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the taxes in the city are extremely high. That's a fact. I think when Duggan moved into the area, he found that the insurance is extremely high. We have Highland Park zip code. So just moving, because I moved from 8 Mile in Woodward to 7 Mile in Woodward, and my insurance went up by 40%. So as a person who's been in the mortgage business for 10 years, I know the city residents are suffering in regards to taxes and lack of service. But I recognize that the city has to make a change. And we have extremely old infrastructure. It's 200 years old. So it's going to have to be upgraded. And we're going to need to attract more residents. That the increase of taxes doesn't help that. But if they do it as they're supposed to, that $500 or whatever dollar amount is going to end up being will go directly to the association, and that will provide additional improvements for this, because we have a variety of different services that we provide to residents. Music or jazz in the park, music in houses, tours, all types of things, providing additional things. So this will help in those for the additional services that you don't get any other neighborhood.
Okay, that was Palmer Woods resident Edwin Cole speaking with Detroit Today producer Jake Neer about his neighborhood's choice to pay higher taxes for better services. And we're going to spend a good part of the hour today talking about this issue. Should certain neighborhoods, if they have the means and everybody agrees, should they be able to buy services that you can't get in other areas of the city because people don't have as much money or as much organization? Is this fair? What does this say about the economic imbalances we already see among Detroiters, between Detroiters in different parts of the city? Does this make it worse? Does it make it better? And what about the overall tax burden? Raising taxes in places like Palmer Woods or Sherwood Forest, where the taxes are already very, very high, does that maybe discourage people from moving back in and helping us with population? So, like I said, we're going to spend a good part of the hour talking about this. 313-577-1019 is the number if you want to join the conversation. 313-577-1019. And you can also go to Twitter and use the hashtag Detroit Today to tell us what you think about these higher taxes. And we already got some folks going on Twitter. But right now, I want to welcome council member James Tate, who is the one who sponsored these special assessment tax measures for council. And welcome to Detroit Today. Councilman, welcome back to the studio here.
Thank you for having me, sir. Appreciate it.
So let's talk about why, in your judgment, this is something we ought to be doing.
Well, let me just say, first of all, this ordinance is optional for neighbors. And I think that if you just listen to the gentleman's comments without Ms. Edwin's comments without any context, you would think that this was something that was being pushed upon the residents.
Sure.
And no, that's not the case. What this ordinance does, it allows, it gives residents and options in throughout the entire city of Detroit to create the district, also to contract out with those various services that they would be receiving. But then also, they're the ones who would have to go out and determine if they're going to actually absorb these additional assessments. And so you have to do so with a get 51% of the signatures, signatures from 51% of the tax owners within that particular district that they have defined.
Yeah.
So for me, it wasn't so much I'm pushing it. Right. It's me saying, here's
an
option.
Open the door if you want to walk through it.
If you want to do it,
here
choice. It is. It's available. Because there are a number of residents from the city of Detroit, citywide, who said this is something that interests them.
Yeah.
And for a number of years, I would say a couple of decades, I know back Mary Ann Mahaffey, even all the way back in her era, there was an opportunity to do this, but it never crossed the threshold of city council. So we were never able to get the legislation passed. No council member would push it because this is a, you know, it's a controversial thing.
It's an equity issue in a lot of people's eyes. Yeah. I mean, and I want to ask you about the debate on city council when you brought it up, but I would imagine that you heard from people, either your fellow members of council or other folks who spoke up, who said, you know what, this is elitism, and you know, this is Detroit. You can't introduce ideas like that without an argument. I mean, this is a place where we are very sensitive to and very well aware of the kinds of unfairnesses that visit upon people in certain parts of the city, that visit upon poor people. This seems to sort of agitate all of those imbalances. What's your answer to that?
Well, you know, what I've learned in my short time in elected office is that no matter what decision you make, you're going to have people on all different sides. You're going to have folks who agree, some who don't agree, some who don't care, and some who say, well, I'll follow up when it comes my way. And that's what we're having here with this discussion.
Yeah.
One thing that I've told neighborhoods who are seeking to do this, it is critically important not just to seek, you know, comments and concerns from 51% of the community, because if you only have 51% who are aware, then you got 49%, which is almost still half and half,
almost half, sure,
who's not going to be happy about this, and they're going to balk. And as a matter of fact, we had some individuals from Palmer Woods who came after the neighborhood got the 51% of signatures. They showed every burden of proof that they were eligible for this district and the assessment. Then we have folks who came by later on and said, well, I didn't know anything about
it. No one told me.
No one told me. And that's going to happen, you know, unfortunately. But the thing that I've encouraged the neighbors who are actually going around getting these petitions, the ones who are going around seeking the support from the community, is hit every home. And that's what the Palmer Woods folks said they did. We're having that situation. So in I represent District 1. And right now we're having that conversation in Grandmont Rosedale. And that's five communities.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine
the lot of
hurdle.
People.
Yeah, that's a huge hurdle to get over. So now the conversation is actually happening. There have been a number of community forums. There have been newsletters that have gone out. There's a lot of information that's out there. For me, this is an opportunity for the community to actually engage itself on its future. What do we want to look like moving forward?
Yeah.
But it's a huge hurdle to get five neighborhoods on board for this assessment. Because again, 51%.
But also in your district, you have communities like Brightmoor,
mm-hmm.
where the means of the people who live there are a lot different than they are in Grandmont Rosedale or in Sherwood Forest or in Palmer Woods. And sort of, you know, the question always comes up, is it fair that people in Grandmont Rosedale, because they might have some more access to cash, can get things that people in Grandmont or in Brightmoor might not be able to access. I mean, talk about how you as the councilman could even explain that to folks in Brightmoor, you know, who would say, well, hey, what about us?
Yeah, well, let me just say I love Brightmoor. my wife grew up in Brightmoor. My sister lives in Brightmoor, so I've got a great connection with Brightmoor.
And you represent Brightmoor.
And I represent Brightmoor and Grandmont Rosedale and other neighborhoods as well.
Yeah.
But the reality is the neighbors themselves are the ones who determine if this is something that they want to do. I mean, this is not, I have to keep emphasizing that this is not something that's being pushed at all by the government or onto the government. I have not been a part of any of those community conversations advocating for it.
Right.
I've been there saying, hey, this is the law. This is what happened. This is the process and how it came about. Now it's up to you all. And so if Brightmoor wanted to do it, they have the option to do it as well. Now, financially, they may be a little bit more strapped than some other neighborhoods. And that's the same thing all across the city. Some will, some won't. Some people will be able to afford a dog. Some people won't be able to afford a dog. Some people will be able to afford this high-priced vehicle. Some people won't. I mean, this is, it's about now making sure that the basic services that people receive are up to snuff.
Right.
That's what I'm focused on.
Yeah.
I'm not focused necessarily on the special assessment piece. How do we increase the basic services that we receive from the community? Because as a resident myself, I see some holes that I would like to see.
All do,
and I live in Grandmont Rosedale.
Yeah.
And so when you look at it, it's again, this is about the community itself determining its future.
Yeah. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. My guest is James Tate, the city councilman from District 1 here in Detroit. He's also the sponsor of a creation of a law that allows neighborhoods to create special assessment districts where they can impose special taxes on themselves to get services that are different from other parts of the city. We're talking about whether that's a good idea, whether that's fair. What does it say about equity here in the city of Detroit? If you want to join this conversation, give us a call, 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. Or go to Twitter and use the hashtag Detroit Today and tell us what you think. Valerie at the Detroit Golf Club, you are up first today. Welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning, Stephen.
Uh-huh.
And I want you to know how much I appreciate you and your show.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
One comment I want to make clear is that these are private, not city services.
Right.
And secondly, that these services are not new. They've been paid for all along by some people. And the big difference is that now everyone receiving the services will also be paying for them.
So in other words, what you're saying is that you if you lived in Palmer Woods, for instance, I mean, we all have seen the private security that they had there before. You're saying that what does this change about that?
This changes is that previously X number of people were paying for that private security, but not everyone.
I see. Okay.
But as you might expect, the assumption certainly is that the climate is improved by having them present. And so the difference is that now
everyone will share the
within
cost.
The confines of that defined community will be paying.
Yeah, yeah.
No, and that's, this is better for the rest of the city because now the police are not worried about our neighborhoods as much.
I see. So you feel like the special services there will sort of displace the need for, say, DPD to pay as much attention. That's really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
It That's
has
a really
already.
Interesting point.
I mean, a comment that Chief Craig made at one of the district meetings was that whatever you guys are doing here around security is great. Keep it up.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you look at maps showing where there indicates crimes by dots on the map,
right.
These communities are blank spaces.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Valerie, thank you very much for that call. Councilman Tate, the point she was making about making it easier on other neighborhoods by freeing up state-paid-for resources or government-paid-for resources in order to let them patrol other neighborhoods, it's something that you don't necessarily automatically think of here. Do you see that as something that can actually happen?
Well, you know, I don't look at it from that perspective. I think that's something that the community, you know, that's their selling point. For me, it's about how do we make sure that we have the basic services for all neighborhoods as a whole.
Yeah.
If you look at it, Mayor Duggan would tell you and Chief Craig would tell you that the response time has decreased, if you will,
yeah.
When it comes to getting to and from. And the neighbors, folks in the communities will tell you that as well. That's the main thing. What we're talking with the special assessment district ordinance, what it allowed for was a extra layer of services. And so, like the caller indicated, they already had security services that were there. Now, some, like what's being debated within Grandmont Rosedale, you'll have the opportunity to have off-duty secondary employment officers who are in police uniform in a police vehicle cruising the neighborhood. And the reality
that they're
paying for themselves,
right,
through their assessment. The bad guy doesn't know if these are officers on second, if they're on the secondary employment, or if they are officers who are working directly for the police department at that time. The beauty of it is those particular officers have the connectivity to the actual department, whether they're on or not. So that is, to me, the most beneficial part of it. It is a layer,
yeah,
of services. And if you talk about, so let me just go back. There are only three services that can be, or three areas where the state
that
law
you can
allows
do, yeah,
for the special assessment. One is security services. The other is mosquito abatement. And the third is snow removal. And so we do all of those things,
yeah,
in the city of Detroit. It's just a matter of,
I don't think most people know we do mosquito abatement.
Yes, we do it, but the challenge is we don't have enough resources.
Right.
You know, again, for,
right,
the mosquito abatement, we don't have enough resources. So every neighborhood would not really apply for the mosquito abatement. If you're talking about areas where you have a high water table, then yes, you know, over by the Rouge River or something like that.
Yeah.
When you talk about areas, everyone has an issue with the snow, right? So the city, we go out and we plow the snow, but we go straight through the middle. That's it. And we only
these giant hills on either side.
Absolutely,
of the street.
Yeah. Absolutely. So now we're talking about the neighborhoods being able to say. So you're still going to get those services. We only plow up the when it gets up to 6 inches. You can contract for 2 inches.
Right.
You can contract,
right,
for three. And so this is again another layer of services. We're not taking away anything from those particular neighborhoods who decide to enter into the special assessment district. What we're saying is, if you want this extra layer, you're going to have to pay for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's an option for you now.
Let's go to James in Auburn Hills. James, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Appreciate the show.
Sure.
My question is this. You had raised the issue of fair and equitable distribution of the costs versus access to the service. I wonder if you can provide some comment, and you guessed as well. Is this akin to what Gilbert and Illich are doing downtown? For example, you have a brand new hockey arena. I'm guessing that you won't have necessarily all the residents of Detroit flocking to that arena, or you have Gilbert who is purchasing buildings and property, repurposing that. I find it hard to believe that when you have people who are in the outlying neighborhoods, say, for example, Chalmer and 94, are they really, or do they have the means to go ahead and enjoy these services, even though they may be paying for them in their state taxes or their local taxes? Is there any connection there, and can you provide some insight on that?
Yeah, no, James, thank you very much for that call. You know, I think there's a specific question that James is asking that I'll ask you to address. But in general, I think that comparison to what is going on downtown, for instance, where a lot of people feel like there is a lot of private security. There are cameras in places all over downtown. And there's been a lot of discussion about how that changes the nature of the city. How does that make people feel in terms of being welcome or not welcome in downtown? And it raises a question of who is it for? And I think it's interesting to connect that issue, as James is doing, to this question of extra services. I mean, and that gets to those really thorny issues that we keep coming up against here in Detroit, because it's a place of such deep economic division that people are very nervous about the idea of creating sort of spaces that are inaccessible to everybody, or creating spaces that are better for some people, and that, you know, maybe I won't be welcome there. So talk specifically about what James was asking about, the direct comparison, but also talk about that bigger context.
Well, I think as I said before, the main concern should be, how do we raise the so-called floor, not how do we increase the ceiling, so to speak. I think what we have to look at is what's happening in Southwest Detroit. They have this thing called the Business Improvement District, yes. The BID. This is essentially the same thing, and they've been doing the BID for well over 10 years now. And I think they're up for renewal soon in downtown. They've actually done the same thing, a Business Improvement District, where right. the businesses are assessing themselves.
And
they pay for these services. So yeah. It's the same thing. So we've already had this concept around, but it was only available for the businesses. And once again, here we are as the city of Detroit trying to look at things a little bit differently now, not just allowing the business community to enjoy, you know, the nature of legislation, if you will.
Right.
We now want to make sure that the community has an opportunity to do that as well. So this is pretty much the same concept that has been already introduced for the business community, now being allowed for the people in the community. So yeah. I think the thing about the city of Detroit is, you know, we don't like change very much. And I think
I hadn't noticed that, James.
Yeah, and it's not even, I don't know if it's just even Detroit. It's maybe just a human nature. We just don't like change. Yeah. And
well, so, we get very nervous about change and how it will affect our sense of you know, being able to access the things around us. I mean, I think you talk about Belle Isle, and you and I have talked about yeah. this before on this show, changing just the governance of Belle Isle, who mows the grass, mm-hmm. who takes mm-hmm. care of it, implicates lots of other things in the minds of Detroiters. Absolutely. About, you know, is this my park, or is this somebody else's? Am I a guest here, or is this mine? Can I sort of own mm-hmm. this? Those are really sensitive issues to a lot of people here in the city, and there are strong historical reasons for that, right?
And I agree, but the thing you don't want to do is take yourself out of the process because you don't like it. What you do is you want to get involved. So that's the same message that I'm telling to people who are opposed to the special assessment district, because there's a lot of folks. Again, you have people on both sides of the argument, yeah. both sides of the coin, some who agree, some who don't. I say, don't take yourself out of that process. If you don't believe in it, then you need to advocate just as strongly to the rest of the community, to your neighbor, saying, this is not what we want.
Right.
But this has to be something that is, again, generated by the community. I think, to me, this is now more of an opportunity for the community to play a role in the city of Detroit and how we govern, because ultimately you're taking it in your own hands and in terms of how
right.
things are going to be going in your neighborhood.
Well, I think one of the things that'll be very interesting is to see whether neighborhoods outside of Palmer Woods or Sherwood Forest or mm-hmm. Grandmont Rosedale, neighborhoods that we all think of as more stable and with wealthier residents, if other neighborhoods,
more middle class,
well, that's
more
right.
middle class,
yeah, right. I mean, we have a warped perception of
more middle
sort
class.
Of economic status here in the city. Mm-hmm. But if we see other neighborhoods that are not thought of in the same economic class, if we see them organizing around this ordinance to try to figure out how they might get better services, I think that changes the nature of the conversation somewhat.
I think so, but again, it has to be driven by the community.
They got to decide to
do it. They have to decide to do it themselves. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, imagine how horrible this would be if we as the city government say, okay, we're going to pick neighborhoods that we're going to allow to do this. That's not how this should work. Let's
let everybody do it, and those who choose to will take advantage.
There it is.
All right, Councilman James Tate, District 1 here in the city of Detroit. As always, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
Detroit
me, sir.
Today. All right, I'm going to take a quick break. When I come back, we're going to talk with a professor of economics at Wayne State about this same issue. Should some neighborhoods be able to buy better services for themselves than what other neighborhoods have? And stay with us on the phones. Tom in Northwest Detroit, Mark in Detroit, Angela in the University District. We will get to you when we get back. If you want to join the conversation, chime in at 313-577-1019. Stay with us on Detroit Today.
Music,
culture,
arts,
news,
local,
global.
The new sound of public radio.
1019 WDET Detroit.
You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and thanks for being here. We are talking about the kinds of city services people should expect to receive for the taxes they pay, especially in places with high property taxes like Detroit. Some of the city's more stable middle-class neighborhoods near the Detroit Golf Club have chosen to raise their own taxes for better security, for snow removal, and other services. Let us know what you think. Is that fair? Should individual neighborhoods be able to raise the level of services for themselves, even as other neighborhoods around them maybe don't have the means to do that? And if you live here in the city of Detroit, would you choose to raise your own taxes if you could get better services? Or are you getting the kind of value from your city that you think is appropriate for the taxes that you're already paying? We're going to be joined now by Wayne State University Professor of Economics, Alan Goodman. His research includes housing economics and urban development. Dr. Goodman, welcome to Detroit Today.
Good morning, Stephen.
Yeah. So I wanted to have a conversation with you about this sort of broader context of the tension that already exists in cities like Detroit between neighborhoods that are stable and neighborhoods that are unstable, between people who have money to be able to make their lives better in the city and people who don't. I would imagine that this issue fits into that context, but that context is much broader, and it comes up over and over again with regard to cities and the way that they deal with housing and urban development.
The fact is that areas like Palmer Woods have already been doing this.
Yes.
I was visiting with a colleague some years back, and I kept seeing the security car going past the house over and over again. And I asked him what that was about. He says, well, we pay extra for this security. So in that sense, what this is doing is codifying a practice that has already been going on. When I talk, I live in Huntington Woods. And I just said to one of the staff members that in a sense they're recreating Huntington Woods within the city of Detroit. Because in Huntington Woods, there's a joke that there's never been a levy that's failed. And you vote for various types of services. I think that the distinction there is that you can immediately see the services. I think that a lot of folks in the city rightly say, gee, I'm paying a lot of property taxes. I ought to be getting this. And for reasons that are beyond the scope of this discussion, they may not be seeing these services. So I think one of the keys is the actual relationship of the perceived services to what you're paying.
Right.
And what you're saying here is, Here are citizens in certain neighborhoods who can choose to pay a little more and see better services. And in an economic sense, that's an appropriate expectation. It's frustrating, I think, for people in other neighborhoods who may be paying a lot of money and are not seeing those services.
Sure, sure. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. My guest is Dr. Alan Goodman, a professor of economics at Wayne State University. We're talking about the move by the Detroit City Council to allow neighborhoods to create special assessment districts for extra services, police, security kinds of services, snow removal, mosquito abatement. City Councilman James Tate was just here talking about that as one of the things that these districts can do for themselves. If you want to join the conversation, do you think these districts are a good idea? Do you think they're fair? Do they raise issues of equity and fairness in cities like Detroit? On Twitter, someone with the handle TaylorMade Media says that race is also an underlying factor and that we have so far dodged it on the show. We have not talked about whether there is a racial component to this. What do you think? 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. Let's go to Mark in Detroit. Mark in Detroit, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
A question I have, a clarification, actually. Does the neighborhood vote have to be 51% of residents or 51% of property owners?
So I think Councilman Tate addressed that up front, that it is taxpayers, right? It is the people who pay the taxes on the home. So in most neighborhoods, or in many neighborhoods, I should say, you would have people who, for instance, don't live there and own maybe an apartment building or a house that's divided up into apartments. And it would be the owner, I would imagine, who would be asked about this assessment, not the people who are renting there.
Okay, because that kind of changes the situation in neighborhoods with high rentals, obviously.
Sure.
People are not as invested in the property per se. Another couple observations is obviously this plowing of the streets, whether it's private or whether it's public, works a lot better in a neighborhood that has driveways, that are newer neighborhoods. If you have a neighborhood in the city that was built before the mass production of automobiles, it is very difficult to plow streets with cars parked on
when the cars are on the street.
Driveways.
Sure, sure.
And so does it would, and my third observation is the contractors that would do this if it were voted in a neighborhood, are these the same contractors that the city contracts to plow the streets when we get a 6 inches or plus snowfall?
In other words, are these going to be the same contractors?
Correct, yeah, because right. the city contracts out
right.
a lot of that plowing
right.
During snowstorms. So these guys, I'm assuming since they're already in the pipeline that they're going to get some of these contracts, but how well will these services be rendered if they're out doing the city thing first, right. and then they'll hit the neighborhood?
That's a great question. I don't know that I know the answer to that, Mark. Dr. Goodman, I wonder if maybe you can shed some light on what happens in other cities. I mean, this is not a new phenomenon in most cities. It's newer here. We're sort of late to the game and officially sanctioning this kind of thing. But what about that in other cities? What effect does it have on city services more generally when you allow these special assessment districts to sort of create, special service districts?
Well, again, as I said before, we have been doing this, although in a less formal manner here in Detroit.
Yeah.
What it does, in a sense, is it makes the city more like the suburbs. Because, for example, if you go along the north side of 8 Mile Road, you have St. Clair Shores and East Point and Warren and all of these other suburbs going across, and they're all different, okay? Mm-hmm. They have different set of services, and they have different types of schools, and they have different parks and everything else, and people choose to live there based on that. So in that sense, we have that kind of experiment.
the classical central city, like Detroit or Cleveland or Chicago, what have you, has had a lot of economies of scale in terms of size, in terms of providing water,
yes,
and providing roads and providing various types of infrastructure. But it could very well be that some of these large cities have gotten too large to be able to match the preferences of neighbors, of people who live in specific neighborhoods. I'm not familiar with other cities that have explicitly put together tax settings the way this is being proposed. But certainly, again, within Detroit and again in other cities, there have been abilities at the neighborhood level to pay extra amount,
right,
for extra services. Again, one can ask whether everyone ought not be getting the same amount of service, but we know that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to take one more call here before we end the segment. And Angela in the University District. Angela, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hello, am I on?
You are on.
I live in the University District, have for many years. Uh-huh. I rent. I don't take taxes.
Uh-huh.
But basically, I've been invited to tax myself every year. When I'm doing my annual stuff, I send better than $200 to a private security organization that patrols in the area.
Uh-huh. And you do that as a renter. That's an interesting interesting wrinkle to that. This new assessment, I think, would only go to the homeowners, the taxpayers.
Right. So yeah, my landlord would pay for it, yeah, if that happens.
Yeah.
But I want to be safe just like everybody else, and I want to have the availability of that service. So basically what's happening is that people are already paying in memberships like the Security Patrol or a membership in the University District Association will have perhaps less to pay. I don't know. You'd still want to be a member and do the neighborhood things. But some of that money would shift to the city, and we'd be getting the same services.
Right.
So I don't think anybody thought of it like we're rich so we can do this. The cohesiveness of the neighborhood is fostered by this, and that's really the secret to making this place a wonderful place to live.
Yeah. No, Angela, thank you very much for that call and for sharing those thoughts. Dr. Alan Goodman, professor of economics at Wayne State University, I want to thank you for being here on Detroit Today.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And I'm sure this is a conversation we'll come back to as this unfolds across the city, and we'll talk to people in neighborhoods as they organize around the idea of these special assessment districts. All right, up next, we're going to have our weekly education segment with Bridge Magazine reporter Chastity Pratt Dossey. She's going to join us to talk about Detroit Public Schools' elected school board and their views about the proposed DPS bailout legislation in Lansing. We'll also be joined by a member of that board, Lamar Lemons. He is a school board member at large and former state representative. Stay with us on Detroit Today. You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. Thanks for being here. Republican lawmakers at the state capitol would like to see the Detroit Public School Board ousted and replaced with a newly elected board. It's part of a proposed DPS overhaul that comes with more than $700 million for the floundering schools, and it restructures the school district. Republican lawmakers have used a recent kickback scheme scandal among some DPS principals to bolster their claim that the state can and should make major changes. Here to talk about it is Chastity Pratt Dossey, who is a reporter from Bridge Magazine. She joins us every week on Wednesday. Welcome to Detroit Today. Welcome.
Hello,
back.
Hello.
And also joining us is Lamar Lemons, who is a member of the current Detroit School Board, a member at large, former state representative. Lamar, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm curious about your reaction. I can probably guess what it is, to the idea that the board to which you were elected and have never really been able to serve because the school district has been under state control for so long, that somehow your elected post ought to be sort of pushed aside. And we should be clear, they wouldn't sort of get rid of that board. You would be in charge of the new debt-ridden district that's sort of just there to pay down the debt. And a new board would be elected to manage the school district going forward. Is that a fair solution from your standpoint?
Of course not. If there's any oversight that is needed, it's oversight of the state. Remember, all of these things happen over during the operation of the state. Actually, it falls directly, just like in the case of Flint, it falls directly at the feet of the governor. Governor Snyder has been operating the Detroit Public School District through his emergency manager for his entire tenure, over half a decade. So how can you hold anybody else responsible when you have all the power? It's absurd.
Well, we should also make clear that DPS was put under emergency management by Jennifer Granholm, the previous governor.
That's not quite correct.
Well, sure it is. Correct. It was in 2009, Lamar.
Okay, remember, I think I know a little bit about this. What happened under Jennifer Granholm, the board was put under emergency financial manager.
Sure.
The emergency
and then they changed the law. You're right. You're right.
Okay, the emergency financial manager had limited authority over academics, even though he exercised that academic authority and was found in a court of law to have caused...
to be out of bounds. You're right. You're right.
Not only out of bounds, to have caused irreparable harm to the district, both academically and financially. Yeah.
Lamar, not everyone is totally up to speed as you and we are. Just to give people a little more history, we know that in 1999, Governor Engler in the legislature changed the law and had a takeover of different sorts of the school district in 1999. And at that time, the school district did not have a deficit. And then there was 2009, as you explained, where the emergency financial manager was put in place. During 3 years of an elected school board, the deficit grew, but the deficit has
continued to grow
under emergency management.
Hold on right there.
We only got a few minutes. Let's not go down history. We got other questions.
Wait, give people
the basics here.
but let me get clarity. Because even though the deficit, quote, happened under the elected board, first of all, there was a deficit when the board took over the district in July of 2006.
Well, but there was also a $200 million allocation from the state to take care of that deficit.
There was a bond that was sold.
It was a bond.
We're getting into the weeds here, though, Lamar.
One thing that I was incorrect.
I was there. I covered it. I remember. I'm totally clear on it. But what I'm hoping that we can. We only got 5 minutes, Lamar.
Okay.
let's talk a little bit about the legislation moving forward.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lamar.
Okay. First of all, we want to say that the deficit was created by the state with encumbrances over $1.1 billion. And when they passed the bond, by the time the district took financial control, which is in July, not January. So when the board came in from the 205, the district appeared, and this is where you get it wrong, Steve, it appeared to be temporarily balanced, but in reality, it was, by the time they took it over financially in July, it was in deficit caused by the state.
Well, one thing a lot of people are clear on is that now the state owns this debt
I think what I'm really interested in hearing from you, Lamar, is what your plans would be. Let's say they kept the school board that we have that's elected in charge of the new school district. Give us an idea of what the plan going forward would and should look like from your standpoint?
Well, that's a very complicated question, but I would say, first of all, we would reduce class size. That would be the first thing. And there are finances. I know you don't want to get in the weeds, but we know that the district has the ability to, first of all, generate money our district had $114 million surplus, we could have that again.
At the current population level with the current number of schools?
Let me say this.
You think that's possible?
Let me say this real clearly. The district lost 130,000 students from 1966 to 1999, and it had $114 million surplus. I just want to point that out. So under rapid declining enrollment, the district was still able to manage itself in such a way that it had a surplus.
And you think that's still possible today?
It is still very much possible. Number one, we will recapture a large percentage, which is why they're trying to do everything they can to handicap the district. We will recapture those students that are now in charter schools.
You would? By doing what?
But first of all, by reducing class size, by bringing back programs, by having parent engagement, because currently under the Detroit Public School District, there is no real parental engagement because everything is controlled. No one has to listen to anybody but the governor, just as in the case of Flint.
Well, you know, one thing people have said very publicly is that under state emergency management, the school board, obviously we know, hasn't had very much power, but there's not been an academic plan set forth by the board that would engender I'm trying to set you up here that would say, you know, let's give them power back. Talk to me about your academic plan.
Well, first of all, let me say this. With the district, when the state, and this is something else Stephen misses, David Adamany, when he reported back, he was the first reform CEO.
Yes.
When he reported back to the legislature, he reported back that Detroit was the number one district in the country for free and reduced lunch over 100,000 students. And that's something that they just gloss over. So although we were not competing with middle class schools,
right,
we were the best in the nation.
Lamar, the truth is, I covered the district for 2.5 years in the mid-1990s and saw all of these problems up close then. We had all of those problems then. If you go back and read the clips that I wrote then, we were still struggling with some of these questions that we have now. And I guess my question to you is, what will be different? And I'm asking that not just as somebody who covered this in the mid-1990s and writes about it now. I'm asking this as someone who lives in the city and has children, has to educate kids in this city.
Well, first of all, let me say the number one thing that we did that was stellar is that we created application schools that were performing far above the state level. So if you compare our application schools, like in your neighborhood, the Chrysler School, it is a waiting list. An elected board would create a Chrysler too, and was extremely high and gifted. That's what we would do. We would compete for these students, where before the elected board in the 90s did not have to compete. We would compete, right, and we would get our students back.
Yeah.
So there would not be a waiting list for Chrysler. There may be a waiting list.
You would expand options like that.
Those schools. Just as we talked about Flint, and I happen to be a former legislator who created the enabling legislation, which allowed for the DIA, the All Girls Academy, a stellar school, and the Frederick Douglass School. So we would expand upon that model, not to mention the FLIC that was started, the BASE that was started, and have been the open orthopedic, were created by an elected school board.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. My guests are Chastity Pratt Dossie, who a reporter from Bridge Magazine, who joins us every week to talk education, and Lamar Lemons, who is a member of the elected school board here in Detroit, the board that has not had control of the district for the entire time it's been elected because the school district has been under state control. We're talking about whether that board should get control of the new district going forward and what would happen if they did. Lamar, let me ask you about the superintendent role. There's a temporary superintendent in charge now, Alicia Merriweather. She's a longtime teacher and administrator in the district. If the new board were in control, is that someone you would keep, or do you think that you have another kind of leader in mind?
Let me say this. First and foremost, we would interview all candidates for superintendent. I will say, however, Lisa Merriweather has not met with the board. We still do meet. And believe it, even though we all have very, very limited authority, we do still have some authority. Yeah. And most importantly, the parents still come to our meetings to complain, even though we have, they don't understand that we don't have the authority. So the superintendent, if this current superintendent had any goodwill, she would at least come to these school board meetings, which all superintendents are required to do in a normal capacity. But we would interview any and all candidates.
You know what? Some people might not realize it because the state gave the Detroit schools, like, what, $48 million to make sure that the school district can continue to operate and won't run out of money. People don't realize that that money only lasts through June 30th. So between now and June 30th, there's probably most likely going to be some action on this this legislation that ties debt relief for DPS to maybe having an elected school board that's in power. Talk to me about this idea of a Detroit Education Commission, because that's been a huge debate in Lansing, too, that's tied up with these bills. Some folks want a Detroit Education Commission that would be a level of bureaucracy that would decide when and where schools open and close in Detroit. What do you think of that?
Quite frankly, the Detroit Education Commission is nothing but a mere power grab by the mayor, who during his campaign, because he had been an officer with the EAA, he said, I don't want, the mayor has nothing to do with education, and I don't want education dragged into the mayor's campaign. And now he's trying to backdoor mayoral control through an education commission, which would require the opening and closing of schools to go through him, which would require the contractors and the bonding to go through him.
Well, here's a question, and we've only got about 45 seconds left on the show, and I apologize for that. But do you feel like the Detroit Education Commission is a way to help rein in some of the charter schools, which are operating pretty well unregulated in the city? I mean, if you had that, wouldn't that make the playing field more level for DPS?
Absolutely not.
You don't feel okay?
It's a way to take local tax dollars and funnel into selective charters of the mayor's choice, which, by the way, many of whom contributed to his campaign.
Okay. All right. Lamar Lemons, member of the Detroit School Board, member at large of the Detroit School Board, former state representative. Thank you very much for being here on Detroit Today. We will have you back to talk about this issue again. And, of course, Chastity Pratt-Dossi, thank you, as always, for joining us to talk education.
See you next week.
All right. That's going to do it for us today. I will be back tomorrow. Hope you will, too. This is 101.9 WDET Detroit, Wayne State's public radio station. I'll see you tomorrow.